First of all, I just want to say, well, thank you very much for applauding my drum solo. I really appreciate that very much. And Jess, thank you for providing a little, you know, background guitar on that. I appreciate it. Yeah, very much. Okay, here we go. I just want to say one other quick word about the band. Jess Willard, who's been a guitar teacher for Sonia now for a couple of years, is also a fellow traveler in the Vajrayana or Tibetan tradition, and we've gotten to know each other a little bit, which has been a real pleasure. Caitlin Eystone, my wife and I have known for many, many years. She was a student of Mandy's a little while ago, and even nanny to our children. And speaking of our children, she's going to kill me for this, but because you've welcomed her into your community, my daughter submitted a story to a Write Michigan contest. Some of you may know it's a statewide competition, has preteen, teen, and adult categories. She won the damn thing. So. Okay, she'll never speak to me again, but there we go. To my right, Dr. John Mulder, who it's been my privilege and pleasure to know for probably almost a couple of decades now. I always learned something from talking with him, from our conversations, but also just from who he is. And part of who he is a renowned palliative care physician involved in hospice. If you don't know him or his name, I think you're in for a treat. Today, we've worked on a couple different projects, maybe two or three projects over the years. We're currently working on one, which you're going to report out on at a conference in Austria in a couple of weeks. It's always a great pleasure for me to be involved in conversation with him. In addition to his bio as well, he's the executive director of the Trillium Institute. And if you don't know that, you might want to make a note to go home and Google it. It is a cutting edge, both a research and practical facility for advancing end-of-life care, and he has been instrumental in making that happen. So works on a number of fronts to make living and dying, I think, a much better process than it would be otherwise in our region and throughout the country. He's given hundreds of talks all over the world. So with that, before I embarrass him further, we don't have time to go through his entire CV. I just want to start by asking him the question that we posed and talked a little about in 40 years of palliative care medicine. Somebody asked you the question, which I'm about to do, is there an art to dying? What might you say?
Yes.
All right. Music time. All right.
Well, thanks for the introduction, Michael. It's been a pleasure getting to know you and to work on the things we've worked on together. The work with Michael has taken me in directions that I never really anticipated that I would see, both intellectually and emotionally. So it's really been really neat to have that So anyway, is there an art to dying? I think that the short answer is yes. And when we talk about, you know, art, you know, we talk about the art and science of medicine. You know, sometimes people will look at the science of medicine. Well, that's the, you know, you give this antibiotic for that infection. You treat this particular disease with this particular drug because the science tells us that will help. But clearly, how we engage and how we carry out the practice is it can vary from from A to Z in terms of how that actually happens, how we really engage and negotiate processes of medicine. And people talk about that as being the art, how we communicate with each other and how we really navigate the waters that are in front of us. You all have had experiences with the healthcare system, I presume. You've had doctors and some you've liked and some that you haven't, some that you think that was a great doctor. And some of you think, I didn't care too much for her. And almost certainly, that affinity that you had or that repulsion that you had to a particular provider in the care environment had absolutely nothing to do with the science of medicine. It had everything to do with the art of medicine. how they talked to you, how they listened to you, probably more importantly than how they talked to you, all has an impact on how we really engage that. So I'm going to throw out one other thing, and this is just an appendage to the initial question, and it's probably something that y'all can talk about another day. But just before we came up here, and my wife Lisa, who's with me here today, looked at that and she said, "Is there an art to living? Because we're actually all living right now." And I thought, I don't know that I want to speak on this anymore, because that to me is so much more interesting in terms of how we're living today. But since we have the question about the art of dying, I'd like to just put on the table a couple of realities. And not to be too negative about it all, but if you weren't aware of it, you all are going to die someday. I know. Shocking as it may seem. And the issue, and this came up in our little pre-talk also, is if we really knew for sure when we were going to die, would we live our lives differently? And the answer is almost certainly yes. And for me, one of the curious things is that many people already know that that is on the horizon. Many of us, and I include myself in that group, know what's going to be on our death certificate. We may not know when that's going to happen, but we understand that that's part of the natural trajectory of whatever ails us. And in fact, 90% of us will in fact know that before we die, that that is on the horizon. And yet, we choose often to simply ignore that. About 20 years ago, there was a Tim McGraw had a famous country hit called Live Like You Were Dying. And it acknowledges that reality, that we live differently than, you know, if we anticipate that life is short, all the things we want to pack into that. You hear people talk about bucket lists. And I think it's a wonderful notion in terms of just trying to chronicle the types of things that I think I would like to do before I die. And quite frankly, if I were to go around and poll everybody, a lot of the things would be, I'd like to see this, because I've never seen that, and I heard it was a really, really cool thing to see. I've never been there, and I've heard that that's a pretty cool place to visit. Years ago, if you had asked me, I'd say, well, you know, I like to golf. I'm not a golfer. I would never presume to anyone look at my game and saying, whoa, he's a golfer. But I like to spend time on a golf course, I guess is a better way to put that. And there are some pretty cool golf courses that I've never been on that I think would be cool to spend a little time. For me, it'd be a lot of time on swinging. And that could be considered a bucket list sort of a thing. I've been to 49 states. I've never been to the state of Hawaii. And so you'd say, well, gosh, that seems like a cool bucket list sort of thing. Several years ago, when I was given a terminal diagnosis, a lung diagnosis, at that point in time, I wasn't necessarily thinking that Hawaii was a necessary thing for me to do anymore. I had a kid that lived in Nashville. I had a kid that lived in Seattle, one that lived in San Francisco, one that lived in Denver. I had kids scattered all across the country. And at that point, trips to Denver and Nashville and Seattle seemed to be a little bit more important than clicking a golf course off my list. That reality of the finality of our life here on Earth suddenly changed my perspective in terms of what was important to me. So when we talk about the art of dying, I think that one of the first things that we need to dig into ourselves is, what is sacred to me? What are the things that are most precious to me? What are the things that are most meaningful to me? And how do I want to then structure my life so that everything that I do in life, everything that happens in life, comes back to those values that are most important and most relevant to me. One of the questions that that came up in our little pre-talk was someone asked the question, do we ever find that family gets in the way of the end-of-life journey with folks in terms of just the acceptance and the denial and things of that sort? And the answer was, yeah, sometimes they do. Sometimes it's out of guilt. They don't want to let go because they've not resolved some conflicts. But many circumstances, the issue is that I just can't bear to live life without that person in my life. I can't say goodbye. Not to rely on music, but there was this another, and I'm not really a huge country fan, but a lot of great titles came out of country music, was How Can I Help You Say Goodbye? And so that's part of the art of this. And the first thing that happens is we acknowledge the reality of that. Death denying is a huge, huge issue in our culture. If you go through any town in the United States, you'll see some billboard advertising a healthcare system. You go through Grand Rapids, and we're top 10 in this, and we're top 100 in this, and there's got to be 600 top 100 hospitals in the United States. You know. You will never see a billboard from a hospital system that says, we do death well. And in fact, as hospitals are rated and they like to have these, you know, U.S. News and World Report, you know, top hospital ratings, your mortality index knocks you down. If you have people in your hospital that die, you're a lousy hospital, you know, because you didn't save their lives. Well, here's the other reality. I have really used this terminology with medical students, that, you know, many of whom have these really wonderful, you know, heartfelt, altruistic names, I want to save lives. And I try to remind them, you know, you cannot save a life. All you can do is extend a life. Okay? And what you want to make sure that you're doing is, if you are extending that life, that it is a life that is resonant with that individual's values, purposes, is this something that they would want? And that goes all the way back to my medical school days, which is a long, long time ago, in which I was in a surgery rotation with these neurosurgeons at the VA hospital in Allen Park, Michigan. And they had just finished removing a brain tumor from a gentleman who was in his 70s. And I remember wondering about this whole process in the first place, because this gentleman was very debilitated, was coming to us from a nursing home, had, by his standards, a pretty poor quality of life to begin with. And yet he had this tumor. And in the eyes of the scientists and the physicians there, the correct response to that is to remove the tumor. So I'm assisting on this, what I would say, a fascinating surgery, as they're opening up the brain and going through all these different parts, and, oh, that's what the amygdala looks like, you know, all these sorts of things, you know, to get to and remove this tumor. And I distinctly remember the conversation over the table about the profound debility that he would have as a result of messing with this area of the brain. Wouldn't walk, wouldn't speak, may not wake up. And yet the surgeons were high-fiving themselves for a successful surgery because they got the tumor out. I don't find that particular perspective very artful at all. I can keep talking.
No, I know. I know we can.
You know.
Which I'm very happy about, actually, which is great. But some of the things we talked about in the pre-talk, and then just going off what you said right now, makes me want to ask you a question that we didn't necessarily debrief on beforehand, so if you don't mind. What are people, the 90% who know, we know what our diagnosis is, we know what we're going to die of, we have, you know, at least fairly high degree of consciousness, you know, initially in the dying process. What are people surprised about as they are dying?
That's a great question. I'm going to work around to that because
you could be a, you too could be a professor.
So what are people surprised about? I will tell you that when I ask people who are facing the reality of death, there are two main things that I do explore with them. First of all is the, you know, is what I mentioned earlier, what is sacred to you? Okay, I want to make sure I understand what their values are so we can move forward with the plan. Similarly, I ask them, what do they fear? And that's a really wonderful question also to really, because those are the things that we really want to make sure that we're addressed. And a lot of times, they're, you know, they have fear of suffering, they have fear of pain, they have fear of loss, a lot of those sorts of things. And so what surprises them, you know, I'm going to jump to the end. When people are very close, now we're within days of dying, and people that still have the ability to have conversations and to be conscious. What surprises them is the level of peace that they have, that the level of comfort that they have. There's another, Andy Warhol had this great quote, "It's not being dead that I'm afraid of, it's getting there." And we in the medical care system have set up this expectation of a very tumultuous journey of pain and suffering related to terminal illness. For a lot of people, the surprise is, that never played out. That never played out. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is because the natural process of dying, by physiologically, shouldn't be filled with suffering and pain. I will tell you that we do a lot of things within our medical care system that invoke that level of suffering and pain on people. But the natural process itself should not be. And I'll just, in terms of just as a tribute to the people who do the sorts of work that I do, we're pretty good at it. You know, we know how to relieve pain. We know how to address the reality. We know what happens as people die. And you give me a disease state and we've got a pretty good idea what's going to happen. We can be preemptive and we can help them navigate and negotiate that so that up until the last moment, they can be comfortable, they can be fully aware, they can be, they can have purposeful, meaningful lives. And I think that that surprises people because they anticipate that somehow life is going to, that life in the midst of death is going to be much more tumultuous. I'll just, this is an anecdote from a medical student that I was with. She was rotating with me and we were kind of getting near the end of the rotation, and she was a good student, and we were with an older woman at the bedside, and she was fretful about what this dying process was going to look like, and she kept using this, well, dying this, dying that, and the medical student leaned over, grabbed her hand, and said, "Honey, dying is what happens the last day, okay, the last day." And she says, "You're not there yet." And so, and I thought, I like that. I don't typically call my patients honey, but, you know, if she wants to develop that vernacular for herself, that, you know, I guess that's what she wants to do. But that whole, that perspective of, you know, people say, well, I couldn't do the job you do because I couldn't deal with dying patients every day. To which I now respond, last I checked, all my patients are still living. So the whole issue is about living and living well. And I think that when we talk about the art of dying, it's about how do we take this reality, this disease state, this circumstance, which you didn't ask for, but here you are. We need to be honest, forthright about what it is, what's going to happen, and how do we live well in the midst of that, such that suffering, pain, and uncertainty shouldn't be a part of that.
Terrific. Thank you, John. Which makes me want to ask this question, which I know is on the minds of some people in the room. In light of what you just said, if I, as an autonomous agent, don't want to go through all that, I'm in a terminal state, I don't know when I'm going to die, you're going to help me, you're going to control the pain, all of that's great, but I still want to have control. I want to make the decision. And as you know, there's legislation in Michigan that would pending right now that would include us among those states that allow for some variation of physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, et cetera. Do you want to speak to that for a minute? Are you going to tell me, well, no, you should hang in there because the last days could be really something.
Yeah, that. I have a history of engagement in this whole process going back 30 years. Some of you will remember Proposition B that was in the Michigan ballot back in the mid-1990s, which would have provided Michigan to be the second state in the union to permit physician-assisted suicide. I didn't agree with it then. And quite frankly, just so to show my cards, I don't agree with it now. The language has changed, the perspectives have changed, the science has changed. There's a lot that's changed about that whole process. The language has changed. We now refer to it as medical aid in dying. The one that I really was not happy with when they talked about death with dignity. I'm sorry, that's what I've been doing for 40 years without hastening the death of my patients. Okay. So I think that it's potentially dangerous to give the medical care system the power to end life. Okay. The medical care system, I don't think, is really notable for having its ethics all in a line. People make mistakes. We don't prognosticate accurately. There's a lot that goes on that just makes me uncomfortable putting that power in the hands of the physicians.
Here.
But for me, the real issue with this is what you said. And it's not so much, oh, you gotta hang in there. It's that I have seen the most wonderful and meaningful things happen late in life, beyond where someone has had a terminal diagnosis. The reconciliation of relationships, the spiritual awakening that people will have, the types of experiences that they have with other people that they never would have had they not gotten to that point in life. The other issue is that the requests for medical aid in dying, if you study this and you look at, well, why do people think that they want that? You mentioned one, loss of control. Number one is fear of suffering. Okay. They are afraid because of what they've seen, what they've heard, what they've experienced face to face with loved ones, how they suffered at the end of life, that they just don't want to go through that. They get a diagnosis of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and they say, what a horrible, horrible disease to have. Doc, just, you know, let's get it over with now. Totally missing out on the blessings that come with each day. The joy and the peace that we can find in each day, no matter what circumstance you might find yourself in. I think that it becomes potentially hazardous when we say, if you are feeling a loss of control, or you're feeling like, what's the use anymore? Then logically, why would we stop with just, well, okay, I've got a terminal illness. I don't have a terminal illness, but life just isn't worth living anymore. It doesn't, you know, why should I have to have this arbitrary line in the sand to say, well, if I'm going to die in 6 months, I can take this drug, but if I'm going to die in 7 months, I can't. Well, that seems kind of arbitrary, doesn't it? And the studies have borne this out, that if you look at the European experiences, and even now in Canada, just go north of the border where euthanasia is now legal in Canada, where it extends to Not that I want to get out of this, but you know what? That life over there does not seem to me to be worth living anymore. So we will assist them out of their suffering. They haven't said they're suffering. We interpret that as suffering. You know, severely damaged children, for example, in the Netherlands can be euthanized out of compassionate intent. But you can see where the challenge in that is in terms of where do you draw the line in terms of allowing that? In terms of the imminently dying, in terms of terminal illness population, I just have seen too many wonderful, beautiful, miraculous things happen at the end of life. And to believe that that could be taken away from people by an arbitrary decision on a day when they're feeling out of control or feeling that they're afraid to suffer, it just concerns me.
There is no talk back today. So if you would like to engage Dr. Mulder further on that particular issue, you're going to have to invite him back another time. We'd like to close with this. Those of you who've been following my career at C3 closely know that occasionally I drop a reference to the healing and otherwise efficacious properties of things like psilocybin. And the project that we're working on is looking pretty carefully at the research and what it's telling us about ways in which psilocybin in particular can be very helpful in palliative and hospice medicine. So with a couple minutes we have left, I'm going to ask John to talk a little bit about his experiences, especially with ketamine, and then this prospect of opening up palliative care medicine to greater use of psychedelics and entheogens at the end of life.
Sure, this is a huge topic within my industry, the end of life medicine, and in terms of, again, it gets to this whole point about how can we really help people achieve a level of peace and enjoy at the end of life, and what are the barriers that are keeping them from experiencing that, and how can we open up those areas of the brain that would allow them to really fully embrace the reality of what's happening in their life. As Michael said, I've had experience in prescribing ketamine for probably 25 years. I've had a long history of that long before it was popular and long before you could make money at it. And but it's really what it has done in terms of really helping people with reversing the despondency, reversing depression, reversing anxiety, allowing them to experience what's beyond the cloud is has been really meaningful to see how that has really helped people. And there is a bit of urgency at the end of life, right? You know, if someone is going to die within a few weeks and they have depression, for example, well, you start them on an antidepressant, there's only a 50% chance that it would do any good anyway, and it's going to take 2 months to kick in. You know, the standard pharmacology that we use for the treatment of anxiety and depression doesn't necessarily apply at the end of life. So we need creative ways of helping people to deal with the existential realities that they're now facing. Everybody's in a different position. Some people are perfectly content with their position, with their... I've had a seven-year-old who was wise beyond decades in preparation for death. And I've had 90-year-olds who were fretful beyond measure. Okay, so it has nothing to do with age, but everyone has a different level of their existential maturity and their spiritual journey. And everybody's a little bit different. My experiences with psilocybin have been much more recent, and I probably largely because Michael dragged me into it that I now find myself with this level of interest and participation in that. And what I can tell you is, in terms of just a summary comment, it has great value. The folks that I have encountered that have had the opportunity to use this at the end of life. I mentioned that people experience peace, and I've seen that time and time again. The experience with psilocybin has seemed to push that to another level in terms of people who are still having some level of distress, people are having some level of discontent and uncertainty about what life means at this particular point in time. Not the abject, oh, I need to make up with my brother because we had spats over the years. It's not that. It's our connection with the universe and our experience as a human being in this environment and how we become enlightened to our presence and our spirituality that I found that has been useful for a lot of folks at the end of life. Just going to leave it there.
I think you can see why I like spending time with Dr. Mulder. So join me in thanking him for the conversation today.